Why don't we start?
Ooh. It's too flashy.
Okay. Oh, sorry. Okay. So, let's remove some other probabilities. So, last time we talked about multi-layer networks and multi-layer perceptrons and how we train them using gradient descent. So, we've got this situation where we have inputs, hidden units, and outputs. And the way the network works is that we have this weighted sum of the inputs. We take a transfer function, we then take a weighted sum of the hidden units, and we take a transfer function and get our outputs. So you can write the overall equation, forward equation of a network for a particular output k, like this, and just so you can remember, you know, we define sort of the kind of sums you make as you go along using different symbols. I thought it might be useful to put these braces on this picture. So, the B's are the weighted sums at the inputs before the activation function. That's the, we call them the activations. The Z's are the output values of the hidden units after the transfer function. And then the A's are the weighted sum of the input units before the transfer function. And the Y's are the outputs of the output units. Did I say input units there? I meant output units. So that's the setup of the whole system. It's one of these things where you kind of look at the notes and slides, and it looks like there's too many symbols. And of course, you could do it with fewer symbols. All you really need is the, you know, X's and the W's and the Y's to an extent. But having these things as kind of consistently named for symbols just makes it easier when you come to do the differentiation. The other thing, again, is that the kind of All the partial derivatives look really long and complex, but again they're not that bad because you're just taking the chain rule and so on. So we've got two sets of derivatives that we really, or just one type of derivative that we care about. It's the derivative of the error with respect to each weight, or the partial derivative of the error with respect to each weight. And remember, that's what we care about because we're dealing with the weight space, and the function in the weight space is the error, and we'd like to find the minimum error for a particular training set. And finding the minimum error in a weight space means finding the settings of the weights that corresponds to that minimum error. And that's a good thing because that's what we want to train our network to do. So if you remember, we sort of have two sets of derivatives, and for all these things we have the same form. So if you remember sort of nothing else, you for these things, the form of the derivatives, I'll call it the derivative of En, the error of the nth pattern with respect to a weight, it's got two terms. You have the delta value at the output of the weight, and then the value going into the weight. So this would be, in this case, if it's a hidden to output connection, the delta value at the output of the weight, delta k, well, that's easy to get. It's just yk, this is for the nth pattern, minus tk. Now, that's more or less it. It's a little bit complicated because you've got to have the derivative of the transfer function, this g function on the output. But the derivative of the transfer function is easy because g prime, if it's a sigmoid, just equals 1 minus g. And then you've got your input to hidden weights, and the issue there is computing the deltas. So again, for the input to hidden weights, wji, you have, for the nth pattern, you have delta j times xi. So the thing is that what makes it marginally more complicated than a single layer network is that you need to be able to compute this delta j thing, which is the error signal at the hidden weight. And that's what backprop does. So the way we can visualize it in backprop, the way we compute this error signal is that we take this weighted. The point is that the contribution of this hidden unit to the overall error goes through all the output units that it's connected to. And we're thinking in terms of networks where each hidden unit is connected to all the output units. So the contribution of this hidden unit to the overall error goes through each of the output units. So if you want to get the error signal of this hidden unit, then you need to look at the error signals of each of the output units. And it may seem a nice thing to do to kind of weight the error signals at each output unit by the weight connecting the hidden unit to the output unit. It is a nice thing to do, and it's a nice thing to do because it's actually the right thing to do, and it gets you the correct partial derivative. So it's one of these nice situations where the intuitively appealing solution to the problem also matches the correct solution to the problem. And those are always nice situations to have. So this is what we call backpropagation, and it's called backpropagation because you're kind of like running these connections backwards. So you're running the error signals backwards along the connection, but being weighted by this weight, and this hidden unit is taking a weighted sum. Again, you've got to take into account the transfer of the hidden unit, the derivative of that transfer function. But again, if it's a sigmoid, it's just going to be a sort of H1 minus H term. So that's backpropagation of error that we talked about last time. So now we have ways of computing these derivatives. We can just plug stuff into gradient descent, and what we need to do is to go forward through the network to compute the outputs and the error, and then go backwards where we go and compute the derivatives of the error with respect to each weight. And if we do that, we can do gradient descent. If you want to compute the whole derivative, then you have to take a sum over the derivatives for each pattern. Any questions about this? Good. Let me tell you another thing. I keep on talking about kind of taking the sum over each pattern and taking the partial derivative of the error for the nth pattern with respect to the weights. Sometimes you actually treat these sorts of partial derivatives as an estimate of the whole thing. So rather than taking a sum, so what you should do to get the partial derivative for the whole training set, partial derivative of E with respect to a particular weight, you should take the sum over your big N training items of the partial derivative of the error for each training item with respect to that weight. Now, if you've just got, a dozen training items, it isn't a big deal, and you compute the correct gradient each time or whatever. But in many cases, you can have a lot more than a dozen training items. In many cases, if you're thinking in terms of problems like speech recognition, problems like machine translation, you can have really huge amounts of data where huge is, well, we don't think of millions as huge. Huge is billions of data points. That's really big. So if you've got billions of data points, doing this is not such a great thing to do because you have to cycle through all your billion data points to go and get your expression for the gradient. And then when you get your expression for the gradient, what do you do with it? Well, you've got this very small learning rate. You make a tiny change to the weights. It's okay if you're doing this, just summing over a few hundred patterns. But if you're summing over a billion patterns, every tiny change to the weights involves going through the entire training set. So it's just phenomenally slow. Really useless for really large amounts of data. So, and the sort of algorithms that you want if you've got a sum over the entire data sets are algorithms which can somehow take advantage of a problem, and the MLP doesn't have anything that allows you to take this sort of advantage in a very good way. Algorithms that basically tell you how big a step size you can take in each dimension. That would be great, rather than doing this creepy crawly thing down the or taking these tiny steps down the hill, you know how far to go. And there are algorithms that exist. I mean, there are algorithms for MLP training that try to do that by taking more information to account, but they're kind of expensive. They take second derivatives into account. Second derivatives are, well, you know what second derivatives are, but the thing about second derivatives, if you're doing something like this, you know, WJI WLI or something like that. If you're taking second derivatives into account, that means you're looking at the number of weights squared. So you've got this huge matrix of second derivatives. Nightmare. You know, remember these weight matrices are big. You can have, you know, thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of them. Very, very, very problematic. All is not lost, because you can do a seemingly crazy approximation that turns out in practice to work very well. And this crazy approximation is called stochastic gradient descent. In stochastic gradient descent, what you say is that these individual contributions to the gradient, the gradient of the error with respect to the weights for a single data point, we assume that these are approximations of the total gradient. Now, this is going to be a very, very noisy approximation, right? It's just one of the terms in the sum. But it turns out that it works okay. You're basically taking your average, and you go and make a weight change after each data point based on these gradients for each individual pattern. So you can't guarantee you're kind of moving in the right direction. You can't guarantee you're moving downhill. But on the average, you're going to start moving in the right direction. And if you have a really, really large data set, well, you can think of it this way. Maybe one data point isn't going to give you a good average or a good estimate of the gradient, but you probably don't need all billion data points to get a pretty accurate estimate of the gradient. And what stochastic gradient descent says is that, well, we'll just assume we're getting noisy steps, and that assumption doesn't change anything in the algorithm, really. We're just assuming that, but we're going to take a little step each time. So this is the creepy crawly thing, because you're not going directly downhill. You're sort of going in a direction that is on average downhill, but you have the advantage that you're making changes to the weight matrix every pattern rather than every billion patterns. This is really good, because for some large scale problems, So if you go and take problems where you have, not even super large scale problems, but take sort of speech problems where maybe you have, I don't know, a million frames of data, and that's not much speech. That turns out to be, you know, just a few hours of speech. You take problems like that, and you can basically train your multi-layer perceptron just with five or six passes through the data by doing this stochastic gradient descent approach, where we just go and update the weights after each point. And that's sort of orders of magnitude faster than if you were computing the complete function. It's funny, it's one of these things which kind of was popular for a while, and then I think decreased in popularity, partly because, and this is certainly the weakness, you do have to estimate this step size parameter, this learning rate parameter. So you do have an extra parameter to estimate. So there was a lot of focus on models that admitted, perhaps simpler models that admitted more direct optimization algorithms, or fancier optimization algorithms if you really needed to use gradient-based approaches. But I think it is still the case that stochastic gradient descent, for very many models, even those that have special purpose ways of optimizing themselves, can be as efficient or more efficient. And this includes if you know about or have heard about things called support vector machines, for example. You can actually optimize those models using stochastic gradient descent on large problems probably more efficiently than you can using the special purpose, very, very famous techniques. So I'll leave it there. It's a really simple idea. It's sometimes called online gradient descent because you're thinking in terms of an online thing rather than the batch thing. You're thinking of your data streaming in, each data point, you make an estimate of your gradients and you update the weights. So this is a kind of, if you kind of want to see, you know, in numbers, how you might use an MLP. Here's a worked example. So we have a set of inputs along here, and then we have some current settings of the weight matrix. So this thing's a bias, so it has we've got two hidden units, and you know, weights of -1 and -0.5, and so on. And we also have some hidden to output weights. We take some inputs. In this case, our inputs are 1, 0.5, and 0.5. The bias is always 1. Then, given the inputs, we want to go and compute our outputs. So, for example, this guy, the output will be -1 times 1 plus 1 times 1, which is 0, plus 0.5 times 0.5, which gives 0.25, plus 0.1 times 0.5, which gives 0.75, and then we need to pass that through a transfer function. Likewise, we can do the weighted sum for this guy, and the weighted sum, the activation is -1 from doing like 1 times -0.5 and 1 times 0.5 and so on. We have to pass these through the activation function, through the sigmoid, and you get values of 0.68 and 0.27. Then we do the same or the similar thing for the output units. We take a weighted sum. This one has a weighted sum of -0.45, and this one has a weighted sum of -1.14. So 0.27 times 2 and 0.68 times -1, and 1 times -1 equals -1.14. And we have some targets that these things are aiming for. So this one is aiming to be, we should pass it through the transfer function. And pass through the transfer function, we get 0.39. and 0.24. We have some targets these things are aiming for. This thing's aiming to be 0, and this thing's aiming to be 1. So we can compute our error function. If you like, the color coding here is kind of like red is where we're going forward, and then blue is where we're computing the error and estimating the weights. So we have our error function, which is just a half times the squared differences of the two, so 0.39 minus 0 and 0.24 minus 1. Of those things, so it gives us an error of 0.36. And then we can compute our deltas for each of the output units. So the delta is just the difference from the target, so 0.39 minus 0 and 0.24 minus 1, so 0.39 and minus 0.76. And then the things in the square brackets are the contributions. Are the contributions from the derivative of the transfer function. This is y1 minus y for that one, 0.39, and y1 minus y where it's 0.24. So those are our delta signals, the outputs, so which evaluate to that, and we can immediately use that to go and estimate our gradient. So the gradient, what we need to multiply is 0.27 minus 0.14. So it's the input is 0.27, and the delta value at the output of the weight is minus 0.14. We're assuming a learning rate of 0.1 here, so that gives us a change in the weights of minus 0.04. You subtract the change in the weights, so you get an updated weight here of 2.004. So you can see you really are taking these kind of, you know, each time you get a pattern, you take very small changes in the weight values. Where are we? Oh, yeah. Okay. So then we want to compute the change in weight here. So we computed the previous change in weight. We'd like to find out what happens to this weight. So we need to get the error signal for that hidden unit, which is taking a weighted sum of the deltas. We take our weighted sum of the deltas. That's 0.009 times minus 0.5 and minus 0.14 times 2. And we also have the term again for the derivative of the transfer function. So this is this kind of slightly annoying term which makes these derivatives or these delta values slightly longer because you have to take into account that derivative of the transfer function. But it's just a couple of extra multiplications. So that's our delta value, which evaluates to minus 0.02. So now we've got that, we can again compute the weight change in exactly the same way, multiplying the delta at the output of the weight by the value at the input of the weight, minus 0.02 times 0.5, and we have a learning rate of 0.1, which gives us this change of minus 0.001, which gives us the new weight is minus 0.999, because we're adding that to it, again, because you subtract the delta, and this is minus a minus. So that's in practice how you can go through by hand and train a couple of the weights of this very simple MLP. So in practice, the equations are very simple. The delta values kind of have I hope that it's sort of intuitively easy to remember how they come about, how you calculate the error signal, because you just kind of literally are propagating back these deltas. Being weighted by things. You kind of have these annoying things when you're computing the deltas related to the transfer functions, but that's just an extra thing. Okay. I thought I'd do one more example, and I thought I'd come back to this spoken vowels example that we had in lecture 10. So remember, these are basically the resonances you get in the vocal tract, which are characteristic of different vowels, and this is training data recorded from a number of speakers, I think 50 speakers or 51 speakers or something, making many utterances of these vowels. So that was our training data. And remember, we saw before, actually, this is an interesting problem because the training data is really pretty well fit by Gaussians. It's a Gaussian is a pretty good model for this. And as you'll see, you don't get very much difference using an MLP. So we could fit a Gaussian to each class, and those are the Gaussians we got. So it's of interest just to take this data and to try some different classifiers on it. So that's what I did. So we'd seen the Gaussian classifier already. It's also interesting to note how many parameters each classifier has, because as we'll discuss later, the number of parameters that a classifier has, you can think of, well, that's sort of its complexity. And the more parameters you have to you need to estimate, the more training data you need, because you can kind of think of it in a way that you're trying to constrain what the parameters do, and it's the training data that constrains what the parameters do. So if you have a lot of parameters with respect to the training data, then you might get something which can model the training data very well, but there's kind of no force to try and make it generalize the key, generalize the main aspects of the training data as opposed to the little fluctuations that you find. Anyway, this Gaussian classifier has 50 parameters, because for each class we have a two-dimensional Gaussian. So you have a two-dimensional mean and a 2x2 covariance matrix, which is symmetric. So you have two mean parameters and three covariance parameters. So that's 50 in total. We could also train a single-layer network, which you shouldn't be surprised to realize has fewer parameters than the Gaussian classifier. So this would be a single-layer network with two inputs, 10 outputs. It's 30 parameters, because you've also got the bias at the input. You shouldn't be surprised to think it's got fewer parameters than a Gaussian, because it has this relationship to a particular type of constrained Gaussian, where the covariance matrices are forced to be equal. So that's a sort of simpler model. And then you do have an issue of, again, another sort of parameter to choose for the MLP is how many hidden units. So I just used an MLP which had 25 hidden units, as it happens. So this gives you quite a lot of parameters, 335 parameters, if that's right, because you have 3 times 25 equals 75 input to hidden weights, and 26 times 10 equals 260 hidden to output weights, including the biases. And we trained the MLP by gradient descent, and I did all this just using the standard MATLAB stuff. One more thing, actually, when you're using the MLP in particular, it's not so important for the single layer network. The sort of values that you get for the points here are really sort of quite large numbers. So one dimension varies from from like, I don't know, it seems a couple of hundred to about 1,000, 1,100, and the other dimension varies from 500 to 3,500. And that can actually give you some numerical problems when you're training an MLP. What you can do is just in the same way we saw way back at the start, is you can normalize the feature vectors so that each dimension has a mean of zero and a standard deviation of one. So this just involved computing the mean and the standard deviation from the training set, and then as in the same way we saw before, just subtracting the mean and dividing by the standard deviation. So it, we can just transform the x's to these things I'll call z's. And then training on those things, we find that we get really similar looking results. You get 86.5% for the Gaussian classifier, a little bit lower for the single layer network, and essentially the same for the MLP. So from that point of view, it's not a good example show you why the MLP could be more flexible than the Gaussian. I think one of the things to note is that each class is pretty much clustered together. It's not like you get if you're modeling it with the Gaussian, where you have to model things with like distributions with a single bump, a single peak. It doesn't. It fits this sort of data quite well. In other cases, you can get things where you really do need multiple bumps, and then a Gaussian can fall down. So we saw that before. Those are the decision regions that you get from a Gaussian classifier. I thought it might be interesting to look at the decision regions you get for the other two things. Unfortunately, I only just realized I put them on a different scale, so sorry about that. These are the decision regions that we get for the single layer network. As you can see, they're kind of straight lines, and of course they're quite similar to what you get for the Gaussian. You're just constrained to have these kind of straight line boundaries. And then you look at the decision regions you get for the MLP, and there's some weird aliasing going on there. And you can see that the straight lines are become more curvy, and this is sort of part of the power of the MLP, is that you can get these non-linear and indeed non-quadratic decision boundaries, which we're getting here. So it sort of fits itself slightly better to the training data, but it doesn't make such a difference on the test data. So if we compare the MLP boundaries with the single layer network boundaries, I think you can see how it changes. So that's kind of what I wanted to say about training an MLP. For the last 15 minutes, I just wanted to talk a little bit about generalization. Are there any questions? So if you have an MLP, you have a question. Well, how many hidden units, which is equivalent to how many weights, how many parameters do we need? There are when you move beyond Gaussians and single layer networks, you get many models where you can choose the number of parameters. And the question is, well, how many parameters might we choose? And what we typically want to do is to optimize the system so that the generalization is good. And by generalization, we mean the performance on the test set. That's an interesting point because, you see, optimizing the test set performance isn't the same as optimizing the training set performance, as I've mentioned before. So in particular, if you have a network that's too flexible, then you might have too many weights compared with the number of training examples. So you can basically train the network to reproduce the training data. But it isn't necessarily going to have optimal performance on the test data. The other side is that the network might not be flexible enough. So there's not enough weights, or there's not enough flexibility to represent the desired mapping. And one sort of example of that is if you are using a single layer network, you're constrained to these straight line boundaries. So in this case, it's not too disastrous. This is a pretty good approximation of these sort of boundaries, which seem to represent the data better. But there can be other situations, as we saw when we were motivating the MLP, that the single layer network really, 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 really can't provide the modeling that we need. So what we want to measure is the is the generalization error. So at the moment, we're always training our MLPs based on the training set error, and that's fine. That's a good thing to do. And if you sort of had an infinite amount of training data, that would be the right thing to do. But we sort of have finite amounts of training data, so it may be that the training error isn't the best estimate of the generalization error, which is a tricky thing to think about, because we're basically trying to predict how it's going to perform, how the classifier is going to perform on new data. So one approach to this, which is a very sort of empirical type of approach, is to say, well, what we'll do is compute something we'll call the validation error. Let's just call it the validation error rather than cross-validation error. And in this case, rather than taking the error over the training set, which you've been using to set the weights, we'll use a separate set of data that hasn't been used for training the weights, but we just use to estimate the error. So we have a training set, then we have another set of data, which we'll call the validation set, and we'll judge the performance of the network on the validation set. So the reason we might want to do that is that you can actually get this sort of behavior. So in this sort of behavior, what we've got here is we've got a very, this is just a sketch graph. Along this way, we have time of training, and up here we have the error. And we're in a situation where we have quite a flexible network. So we have a lot of parameters with respect to the amount of training data. We have a lot of hidden units with respect to the amount of training data. What you find is that when you look at the error on the training set, it goes down and down and down. And unless you sort of have some instability because your learning rate is too big, it will carry on going down and down and down until it sort of flattens out. And that looks great. You're kind of doing that in your training set, and you're going to see the error going down and down and down. Surely your weights are tuning themselves perfectly to the problem. But what you find is that if you look at the performance in the validation set, you find two things. One is that the validation set performance, you normally have a slightly higher error, always, than the training set performance, normally, but at all time. And that's to be expected, because you're optimizing your weights for the training set, and this is completely new data. But the hope is that, or you might hope, is that the performance on the validation set is going to pretty much mirror the shape of the curve, or translated version of the shape of the curve of the training error, for the validation error just being a bit higher. But what you actually find is that the validation error indeed goes down as you train, but there can become a point where you find that if you do more training, although the training error goes down, the validation error starts to go up. And you can sort of visualize that. I mean, that's what people might call, that's what's sometimes called overtraining. And what happens there, and what's going on there, is that you're basically over-refining the parameters of your network to the training set, and you're starting to capture things that are specific to the training set rather than more general to the problem. And of course, you'd like to find a way where for all sorts of, you know, not just the validation set, but for some sort of mythical infinite size set of test data, you want to stop at the minimum, or you want to get a network which is working at the minimum of the validation error rather than the training error. Now, as I say, this is a very empirical way to view the problem, and there are many different ways to view the problem. But I think it's an important way to think about the problem. So how do we do that? So one approach is a kind of obvious thing, because you might say, well, keep a validation set and just stop training when you reach that point. And that's absolutely a reasonable way to do it. So you hold out your validation set every pass through the data, whether you're doing stochastic gradient descent or batch gradient descent, doesn't really matter, but every pass through the data, you see how well it's performing on the validation set, and maybe you keep a copy of the parameters as you go through time, and then you just choose the parameters which had the lowest validation set error. And you could train several different networks in the same data, and you could choose the one that performs best on the validation set as the one you think is going to work best on some new data. And if you've got a particular setup for a network, a particular model, and you want an empirical way of estimating how well its generalization will work, but you'd still like to train on all the data, then one way you can estimate that for that particular model is to basically divide your data into n partitions, use n minus one of them to train the network to estimate the weights, and use the final one, the nth one, as the validation set. So that gives you a validation set error for that particular split, but then you can rotate around. So all n partitions of the data take their turn at being the validation set. So that gives a way to estimate the generalization error for that particular model, for that particular configuration with that number of parameters. It's a very empirical way to proceed, but it's quite a practical way. There's some other things you can do to stop overtraining. So as I said, one thing you can do is to control what's called the effective flexibility, and early stopping is kind of one approach to that, where you don't train to as many iterations as possible. So in a sense, the training data hasn't exerted its full constraints on the weights of the network. So that can be interpreted as making the network less flexible. There are also sort of more direct approaches to control the flexibility, and these approaches are referred to as regularization. So that was early stopping. So, yeah, let me before we finish, let me talk about one approach, this thing called regularization. And it's a neat idea called weight decay. And again, it's one of these nice ideas that it's got a nice intuitive, there's a nice intuitive understanding of what's going on here, but it's also got a nice nice mathematical expression. So the idea of weight decay. The idea of weight decay is that you kind of put a spring on each weight. So you can think of training a network, you're computing these gradients, and you can think of the way you're training a network is that your training data is kind of putting, particularly if you think in terms of, say, stochastic gradient descent, your training data is kind of putting a force on a particular weight. So if all the gradients are in the same direction for a particular weight, then you're going to end up, the weight changes are going to be pulling in that same direction. So that's good, it's a consistent force. But you may have a situation where the data isn't really trying to constrain that weight. You get gradients in different directions. So you will get a drift in the thing, but the weight will essentially be doing a random walk. And the way random walks work is that you don't stay where you are, you just kind of walk randomly and you kind of end up somewhere. And that may not be a good thing because you're not taking a consistent force from the training data. You're just ending up partially randomly. So weight decay puts a spring on the weights by saying, well, as well as the force we're getting from looking at the contribution of the weight to the sum squared error, we'll have another force, and this is like the force of conservatism. And the force of conservatism says, unless the data is saying something else, this weight should be zero. And so you've got this mile, well, you can set the parameter. You've got this spring on the weights, which is kind of pulling it down to zero. Now, if you get the data, which is always giving you a gradient, pushing it in the same direction, then that can dominate the force to zero. But the thing about the force to zero is that it's always pushing the weight in the same direction, to zero. So if you're getting kind of gradients in different directions, then that might start, then they might start to be dominated by weight decay. And that's good because you can use it, in a sense, it can sort of reduce the effective number of parameters because it's kind of pulling some weights down to pulling some weights down to zero. Now, put that on your stack, and we'll come back to it in a second. Think of another way of penalizing complexity. You can even think of it in terms of Bayes' rule if you like. But you don't have to. Think of having an error function which not only has our training set error, which is the data term, but we'll have another term, we'll call it the prior term, which is directly penalizing complexity. So the training error term is the usual thing. We could choose the prior term to be the sum of the squared value of the weights. So remember, this is the thing that we want to minimize. So the prior term will be big when the weights get big, and it will be at its smallest when all the weights are zero. But of course, if all the weights are zero, it's very unlikely you're going to have a very good training set error. So you've got to balance these two things off, and you can choose a particular parameter, and there are ways to estimate such a parameter, which I won't get onto. But you're kind of balancing this data term, and you can think of it as a prior term or a complexity term. And we're saying complexity is a bad thing unless we have real evidence from the data that we want that complexity. Now, the sum of the weights squared, that's kind of not a bad thing. You know, sum squared is quite good. You might think it would be better to go and say having sum of the weights squared, having sum of the magnitude of the weights. And that is a very interesting thing to do and gives an equally interesting behavior, which also pushes towards simplicity. The key word there is sparsity, but you can come to that in a future course. So we're choosing the complexity term to be the sum of the weights squared, and we'll have a half here. This is kind of cute, because if you take the partial derivative, you just get the weight. If you take the partial derivative of this respectful weight, you just get W. That's nice, because then when you plug everything into your overall derivative for the derivative of the error with respect to the weight, you get two terms. You get the usual training set derivative plus this term here, which can be seen as a weight decay term. It's a term. Remember, we're finally taking negative of the weights. So if nothing's going on here, then the weight will reduce by a proportion of its current size. It will decay to zero. But if this is always pushing the same direction, outweigh the weight decay term. So that's nice, because we've now got this actually gives us an interpretation of the spring idea we had before. So the spring idea was this intuitive idea. We kind of want to pull weights that aren't being told to do something to zero. We found out that we can write this in terms of thinking of adding a term to the error function, which is trying to measure the complexity, which we'd also like to reduce, as well as reducing the training set error. And then when you get a derivative, this particular complexity term corresponds to doing weight decay when you're updating the weights. And this general approach of adding complexity terms to your data term in the error function is called regularization. So there's lots of possible complexity terms you can have, but the key thing, of course, is that you want them to be for backprop. You'd like them to be differentiable. Okay, so let's finish. It's about time to finish. So basically, I just wanted to talk a little bit about generalization. If you do courses like Introduction to Machine Learning and Machine Learning and Pattern Recognition in future years, you'll get a lot more about these things and go into it in a lot more depth and richness. So that'll do. There's only one more lecture left from me, which is next Tuesday. So it was going to be a kind of review and revision and general and answer any questions you may have. Don't worry if you come up with questions after that, because both KK and I will schedule a revision lecture sometime closer to the exam. But if you do have questions you'd like to raise about any aspects of the course, certainly come along next Tuesday. Otherwise, that's it.